A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rehm, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on October 19, 2003, entitled Credo, Personal and Community. The texts for the sermon are Deuteronomy 4, verses 4 through 9, and Ephesians 4, verses 1 through 6. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
My sermon titled this morning, Credo, Personal and Community. Credo is the Latin first-person singular form, translated, I believe. And obviously that is a personal expression. And yet I think when a community is thought of as community, it might also be legitimate to say we believe in that same sense. Finally, it comes down to that. I believe, you believe, and then there are some things that we share together, that we believe together. Sometimes people will say to me, well, we don't believe that, do we? Or what do we believe about? And I have to say, we don't believe anything. But I understand the question, because there is a sense in which a community is marked by a certain spirit, a certain posture. But finally, this morning, I want to say to you once again in just another way what I have said and has been said here many times. I believe. You believe. And while we share many things in common, it finally comes down to that personal conviction of faith. A faith not simply as the assent to a number of propositions or creedal statements, but rather that fundamental trust, of our lives. And that's a highly individual exercise. Nobody can do that for you. And you can't abdicate the responsibility to anyone else. Church community, church official, whatever. There were a couple of pieces that came into my hand, a couple of items that came into my hand as I was contemplating my fall preaching. And those two items determined the sermon for this morning. One of them was a review article in the Christian Century of a month or 6 weeks ago, a review article by a theologian named William Placker, who was reviewing the newly published four-volume set by Yaroslav Pelikan, the eminent church historian. Published this in cooperation with Valerie Hotchkiss, published just before his 80th year. Not too bad at this point to be publishing a four-volume work. Four volumes, 3,796 pages. The first volume being entitled Credo, 606 pages that you can buy independently for a little under $40. But if you want the four volumes with a CD-ROM, I don't know what that is, but it comes with it if you want. $995. Now, can you believe anybody would invest that much money in four volumes that contain 2,000 years of creeds and confessional statements? That's what Pelikan has done. 2,000 years, right up to the year 2000, of creeds and confessional statements from around the globe, from every conceivable kind of community and denomination and confessional family. four volumes, almost 4,000 pages. That could take care of your leisure time for a while. And it's interesting that Pelikan, well, who has written much, but I have an earlier five-volume set on the Christian tradition in which he traces the theological development over 2,000 years. Pelikan, I have quoted him here, a good Lutheran theologian. He's the one who said, tradition is the living faith of the dead. Traditionalism is the dead faith of the living. An excellent scholar, he's put all of this together, and at the, toward the end of his life, recognizes that what he has just engaged in is an archival exercise. For he is quoted in that opening volume as saying that while many believe that the age of faith per se is not past, certainly the age of teaching the Christian tradition authoritatively by means of dogma or trying to express that dogma in theological formularies, certainly that day has passed. So what he's saying is what I have given my whole life to, and what I offer as this final offering is an exercise in creating an archive for the future. Now, he doesn't mean, I'm sure, that the church is done thinking theologically or that the church is done expressing itself confessionally. But I think what he's trying to say is that we have moved beyond the era of dogmatic, authoritarian, religious prescription. The time of formulating dogmatic statements and absolute creeds is over. And we could go into the reasons for that. Fundamentally, I think it is because we have begun over the last 100 years to think theologically. We have seen how all of this has developed. And we have come to see not the absolute character of these statements, but rather the relative character of these statements. We've come to see how in the process, how all of this has evolved. And so we are less ready in this time to give absolute allegiance to some kind of formulation. We know that we are people on the way, and we know that what the religious quest really is not some externally imposed authoritarian statement of truth on us, but rather, is it not true for all of us? Are we not engaged in seeking to find our human experience illuminated by our religious observance and practice? I think that Pelikan is absolutely right. The day of the authoritarian church, ecclesiastical hierarchy, canon and creed, is past or is passing. I might be wrong about it, but I don't think so, and I surely hope not. The second item that came into my hands about this time was the book I had with me last week, Elaine Pagel's Beyond Belief. It's an excellent study, very personal. As I mentioned last week, Elaine Pagel's gave up the church in her adolescence because of its absolute exclusivism. She was turned off by that. But she still became a religious scholar, and she began her doctoral work about the time that the library found in the sands of the Egyptian desert, 1945, the Nag Hammadi Library. It was a huge clay pot that had some 50 manuscripts in it. In the 4th century, when Athanasius was finally established on the bishop's throne in Alexandria, they were in the process of determining what was to be the canon. Athanasius is the church father who first mentions the 27 books of the New Testament. Well, Athanasius was a tenacious, ferocious kind of a fighter, literally. And what he did was to pass an edict that all other writings that didn't make the cut of the canon should be banned and burned. And probably some monk who didn't like that kind of an attitude gathered some of the most valuable manuscripts, put them in this clay pot, buried them in the Egyptian sand, where they stayed for 1,600 years. Elaine Pagels, in a time of her doctoral work, these documents were becoming available for study, and she did an excellent study, which still is looked to today, on the Gnostic Gospels. As she did that kind of study, she learned all about those early centuries and the formation of the Christian church as an ecclesiastical institution and the theological tradition that formed and shaped that church in those early centuries. Now, she had left the church, but she does this religious scholarship, and she studies particularly that period of the church which was developing orthodoxy. Orthodox means straight thinking. And she was well aware of that period of 3 or 4 centuries during which this diverse Jesus movement was being brought under control, reined in, and given a normative form. Then, as I mentioned last week, she has personal tragedy in her life. And one Sunday morning, out jogging in New York City to warm herself, stops into the narthex of a church and finds herself deeply moved by the music and the prayers and the liturgy. And she goes back and she goes to the lower level of the church and gets into a support group. And she finds her life being nurtured by the religious observance that from which she had absented herself for many years. But just as Pelican sees no future for that dogmatic structure of Christian faith, so Elaine Pagels, who studied the whole formation of that structure, while returning to community, to religious, specifically Christian community, is not willing to return to that authoritarian and dogmatic ecclesiastical structure. For she says, while I learned again the things that I love in the Christian tradition, I also learned the things that I cannot love. And what she cannot love is, part of it is documented in that insert in your liturgy, which I included from her book, page 155 following. I'm not going to read that, but it's just a little section in which she tells about the church father, Bishop Irenaeus, who was a bishop in the 2nd century in France, in the area of Gaul. And what did Irenaeus experience as a leader in the church? He experienced people all over the place. He experienced all kinds of people who were having visions and revelations, who had their own intuitions and their own insights and their own wisdom, and they were all giving expression to it. And in a word, that Jesus movement, that early Christian church, was chaos. It was messy. There was no uniformity of expression of faith. And there was no uniformity of practice and observance. And so Irenaeus was one of the chief shapers of a movement that brought a normative structure to the Christian movement. Athanasius, I mentioned a moment ago, was another one. There were a number of such people. Finally, that Christian movement was brought into a uniform expression when the church was made legitimate by the Emperor Constantine, and we speak about the Constantinian establishment of the church, and all of that diverse expression was brought into an acceptable expression, which was Orthodox opinion. And in a little insert I give you, you can find how nasty that process can become, because what happens immediately when you establish what is in is you also rule out what is out, and the process begins, the process of excluding and of exclusivism and of a triumphalism that claims to have the very truth of God and damns that which differs from it. It is a normal process. It's a human process. We can understand how it happened. We can understand that these leaders were good people who sincerely believed they were doing the will of God. Elaine Pagels is sympathetic to these leaders, but as she indicates, and as we religious leaders don't like to admit, if indeed we claim for your benefit that we have the truth of God, and if we believe that we are the guardians of that truth, and if we believe that for the honor of God and for the well-being of the church, we have the obligation to hold to that authoritatively, then we can do that with all humility. Who am I but a servant of God? Except the servant has honor in proportion to the one he serves. And so if God has invested me with this deposit of faith, then some of the authority of God comes to me too. And as Elaine Pagel says, the process in those second, third, fourth centuries was to create a canon and a creed and a ecclesiastical hierarchy. And I'll tell you what, I was born too late. I mean, I wish I had been born when there was a canon and a creed and authoritarian hierarchy. And I would like to have been a cardinal, if not the Pope. I mean, what a way to go. If you've got the canon, it's here it is. And you've got the credo formulation, and here it is. And if you have the power to enforce it, you are golden. And what I'm talking about is actually what happened very normally, very understandably, in the process of the emergence of the Christian church into a dominant institution. Elaine Pagel says, I can't go back there. I've come to see that I really need religious community. I've come to see that there's a great treasure there that still touches me inside, and I want to expose myself to it. But I can't go back to those things that I cannot love. That authoritarian, dominating dimension marked by canon, creed, absolute, and ecclesiastical hierarchy. I wonder about the future of the church. The Pope, Pope John Paul II, just celebrated 25 years, and we're going to be seeing a lot, I think, out of Rome in these next weeks and months, maybe years, who knows? We know his failing health. Obviously, there were conversations in Rome. But what a marvelous system. He has appointed all of the cardinals that will appoint his successor. So the deck is stacked. How can you lose? Except, isn't it amazing that that dogmatic structure can continue to perpetuate itself in our world today, our world of satellites and internet and 4 volumes of 2,000 years of creeds and confessions? I wonder how long even the Roman Catholic Church can resist the democratizing spirit that undercuts authoritarianism. And I think about a church sort of in between, the Episcopal Church right now, trying to keep from breaking communion. And it's a grand tradition again. But should the leaders of the American church who believe that they have acted with integrity and honesty and in accord with the will of God as they understand it in the determination to consecrate a gay man to the office of bishop, should they back down in order that the body of Christ not be rent? Is the future going to hold for grand ecclesiastical institutions? I don't know. But I know this. And that's why I talk about it this morning, because I want you to be very self-conscious about it. I know this. I am so delighted to be a part of a community, a religious community, a community committed to the religious quest, a community, a Christian, in that it finds its access to God in the face of Jesus, the God of Israel. The Lord our God is one God. And the Jew Paul saying that one God for him was now seen through the lens of Jesus, his Jewish brother. It's Paul who pleads with the Ephesian community to be patient with one another and deal with one another in gentleness and to bear one another in love and to keep the spirit of unity and the bond of peace. He talks to this community. Now, Paul was passionate. Did Paul believe? Oh, of course. Of course. And he was so passionate about it because he did believe he had that apostolic mission. And yet, in his better moments, he spoke to the community. And those were all separate communities at that time, to be gentle and patient, forbearing one another, and to keep that bond of peace and love. I am so happy to be a part of a community like this, which is weak and vulnerable, that in the face of the world is powerless, the best way for a religious community to be is to be powerless, vulnerable, so that we give attention to the things that are really those things to which we ought to be attending, and that is the illumination of our human experience before the face of that mystery. Because finally, it's not some grand ecclesiastical institution or some absolute creed or some carefully defined canon out of which there can be no other light, but it's credo. It's I believe. And by extension, we believe. A congregation that blesses diversity and encourages conversation. Walking together, we're not isolated, atomistic, fragmented folks. We're in community, and we converse, and we care, and we support. But we don't have all of that baggage beyond us. Nor do we have some authoritarian system imposed upon us. We can roll our own and do it together. I'm so delighted to be a part of a place like this, and I'm so proud of where together we have come. It's not for everybody, and we certainly haven't arrived, but we've positioned ourselves to capture the future. Not everybody's happy about that. A couple weeks ago, Don was accosted in the hardware store in Groskop for affiliating with a place like this that doesn't believe anything. And this week we got an email. It came to Barbara. It must be the Religion Center for Religion and Life mailing that stirred this up. The subject is truth. It's from Steve. I want to encourage your organization and Christ Community Church to abandon the liberal, non-biblical perspectives you are putting forth. You are misleading many people who are new believers or not mature in their faith with lies from the pit of hell. I pray that you will preach the gospel of Jesus Christ alone, not your gospel, and teach the Bible as the true and complete revelation of God to man. This will change lives and bring people into God's kingdom, rather than waste time on the useless discussions that you seem to promote. Thank you for your consideration. May God bless you and return you to the truth. Well, thanks, Steve, but no thanks. I've been there. I know about that experience of authoritarian domination and authoritarian absolutism and narrow exclusivism. And I don't ever want to be a part of it again. Because you've spoiled me. You're wonderful. And together, we live before the face of God with confidence, with joy. And it's so good.